Hey there, it's Jim Stengel, host of the CMO Podcast. We're all marketers here, so let's be real for a sec. We all know that your website shouldn't be a static asset. It should be a dynamic part of your strategy to build your brand and drive conversions. That's marketing 101. But 54% of marketing leaders say web updates take too long. That's over half of you listening right now. And that's where Webflow comes in. Their visual-first platform allows you to build, launch, and optimize web pages fast. That means you can set ambitious marketing goals and your site can rise to that challenge. Learn why teams like Dropbox, IDEO, and Orange Theory all trust Webflow to achieve their most ambitious goals today at webflow.com.
What's the first brand you remember making an impact on you as a young girl growing up?
Gosh, that was a long time ago. I mean, Barbie.
Why?
Well, I always wanted to be a flight attendant. So, you know, that always resonated with me, even though my sister tells me, you know, I'm one of four girls, so she remembers our Barbie dolls. We had so many of them. But, you know, that was a brand that really always resonated with me.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. My guest today on the CMO Podcast is Shelley Zalis, the founder and CEO of the Female Quotient, or FQ, the 10-year-old company that curates experiences, media, and solutions that advance gender equality. The FQ is famous for its lounges, which advance equality at the most important global gatherings, places like Davos, CES, South by Southwest, and the Cannes Lions Creativity Festival. One of Shelley's mantras is, to conquer imposter syndrome, you must believe in yourself. And her career is a vivid example of that. Shelley began her career in consumer research and eventually founded a company in 2000 called OTX, a pioneer in the then-emerging field of online research. Shelley sold OTX to research giant Ipsos in 2010 and left in 2015 to found the Female Quotient. Shelley is also the co-founder of #SeeHer, a movement led by the Association of National Advertisers to increase the accurate portrayal of women and girls in advertising and media. Shelley is a supreme connector, a tireless advocate, and a great storyteller. Here's my conversation with Shelley Zalis. Shelley, welcome finally to the CMO Podcast. You are so often proudly called the chief troublemaker. So what trouble are you getting into this week, this month?
Wow. You know what? I just came from Cleveland from Final Four.
Oh, my.
So I have to say it just the best trouble in such a positive, opportunistic way. I mean, look at where we're at, you know, just everyone's watching women in sports. And just to think for Title IX, I mean, perfect timing, outperformed the men, like, whoop, whoop. Now we just got to get them on good timing.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us about your experience in Cleveland. What was really cool about it? What was the spirit? Who did you meet that was interesting? Tell us about it.
It was absolutely remarkable. And just, you know, women supporting women, fans out there cheering loudly, proudly, former players, which you never see that. You don't see that in any other sport. The coaches, come on, that's amazing. And even competitors all, you know, cheering each other on.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just legends. That's legendary status. When you know that 94% of CEOs in the corporate world today played on a team sport, and that's where true leadership comes from, you see that, you feel that. That energy, that momentum, and that's the feminine, not the female, but that's the feminine. That's the empathy. That's the compassion. That's the passion. That's what we're talking about. That's human leadership. And you experienced that, you know, throughout this entire championship. That's what a champion is made of. And we saw that. And we all felt that. We all experienced that. And so I'm so proud to be a part of this. And to bring this forward and to write about it, to talk about it, to reinforce it, and to make sure we're not all just aware of it, but that we are conscious of the implications. And now I hope we're all conscious about the power of compassion, of collaboration, and of choice.
It was so obvious. I mean, I watched it on television all the way through. And just after the game, the whole vibe on the court with Dawn Staley, her team, the fun they have, the energy, the passion for each other, the sport, the respect for the competition. I mean, it was lots of leadership lessons, really, in that 5 or 10 minutes after the game.
And then, you know, you think about the possibilities and, you know, where we go from here. And I can tell you one thing for sure, and I know you're going to agree, Jim, because this is who you are. You don't just go back to what it was.
No.
We go forward, and we have not been investing in women in sports. Why? Because the eyeballs haven't been there. But the eyeballs haven't been there because A, people haven't been watching, but they haven't been watching because A, we don't know how to find, you know, women in sports. And we haven't been telling the stories about the power of women in sports. And so it's a chicken and egg. So we have to in vitro and flip it and not just follow the model that was, but create the new model. And at some point, someone has to start the new pattern and build it, and they will come.
There's no excuses anymore, right? There just isn't. We had Lara Abrash from Deloitte on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she's just been promoted there. She's a remarkable woman. We spent half of the show on the data behind women in sports and leadership. So for all the parents out there, I hope your kids are getting involved for all sorts of good reasons. And I think the example that we saw on that final game with Iowa and South Carolina was just beautiful. But that's playing out all across the country in all kinds of little ways as young girls and young women get involved in sports. So here's the future. All right, I want to get this show going with a bit of a lightning round. And my first question is, how many weeks a year do you travel? You were just in Cleveland. You just got back from New York last night. We talked before the show. You're leaving for Miami.
I was also in Dallas, by the way, for the total eclipse with my family. We chased total solar eclipses. So 20 of us were in Dallas. And it was miraculous because it was a cloudy day. And literally, Jim, this was crazy. Right before eclipse viewing time, the clouds moved away and we had perfect totality and the diamond ring effect. I mean, it was absolutely magnificent.
What was it like for your family? You were there together for that very cosmic event. What was it like?
We as a family have been chasing total solar eclipses. So I've seen probably upwards of 5 or 6 now.
Wow.
It's magical and it's mystical and something that, you know, when you talk about one of the greatest qualities that I look for in a human being is curiosity. And living life in the moment, and it's something my father has instilled in each of his 4 daughters, is living in the moment, having a no regret policy, never looking back, saying shoulda, woulda, coulda, and never missing a moment that matters. And to me, that is a very important quality in an individual, is that curiosity and that journey.
It's the most common characteristic I hear in the show, and we've been doing the show for 5 years, on what makes for a successful CMO, curiosity. That's the one word that comes up more than any other one. Not leadership, not strategy, not team player. It's all curiosity.
I would say there's 2 types of people. Those that see what they see, and that's vanilla. That's status quo. That's the easy path. That's the journey that's been taken, and you follow the leader. Okay, you get the job done. Mm-hmm. And then there are those that see possibility. And by the way, that's scary. And you're pushing an envelope. And you're doing things that haven't been done, and you're willing to look around the corner. And that's sometimes being the first. In my whole career, I've done a lot of firsts. Or, you know, all of these people that did things for the first time. I just say you have to do it the first time. The first time is the innovator that makes a few mistakes along the way. Okay, ouch. The second person is the copycat, but they don't know what's under the hood. And the third is always the sweeper. You know, they now can, they have the ecosystem, they get all the money, and they usually win, and they ride in on that shiny white horse. So I always said to myself, I need to be the first, I need to be the second, and I need to be the third, because there's no one that's going to beat me at my own game.
We've all been there.
You spend millions of dollars each year driving traffic to your company's website, and then the results come in and they're just not what you hoped. On top of that, 81% of marketing leaders say website ownership is a challenge. So, what do you do? Well, you switch to Webflow. Let me tell you why. Webflow's visual-first platform empowers your team to own your company's most valuable dynamic marketing asset, your website. From launching a new site to optimizing for SEO and conversions, Webflow gives you the tools you need to drive business growth fast. Unlock your website's full potential when you build, manage, and host with Webflow. Get started today at webflow.com. All right, let's continue this lightning round, although it's more of a thunderstorm, I think. But this is great. Hey, you began your career in consumer research. Could you talk about how that experience set you up for this amazing leadership journey you've been on since your early days in consumer research? What lessons did you take away from those early formative experiences?
I studied psychology in college. And so, you know, I was never good in the textbook category. You know, I really did not like sitting in the library actually studying. I was a senior in college and I went to the college bulletin board and I saw this job and I thought that I was going to interview for an ad agency job. And I thought, oh my God, ad agency, that sounds really cool. Little did I know it was for a research company, a market research company. It was a company called Video Storyboards and it was animatic testing.
Sure.
And I got the job and never left market research. So I fell into market research. I did not choose it. But what I found that I loved, it was studying people. And I was really good at that. And the analysis and all of that was all about, you know, looking at ads and understanding what people thought about the advertisement. And what I loved more than anything was not the numbers. It was the contextualization of storytelling. You know, while the other people in the company would analyze the specifics of the numbers, I would love telling the stories. And that was really my specialty. And so my entire career was the storyteller. As I rose the ranks in market research, of which I spent 40 something years in, it really was around shaping the narrative. And then one day my father said to me, my father must have been about 70 at the time. And he said, Shelley Fran, I was on an airplane and they gave me one of the surveys. And he said, I took it because of you. And he said, it really annoyed me. And I said, why, Daddy? He said, because I answered all the questions. And at the end, they asked me my age. And I said, okay. And he said, and I lied about my age. I said, well, why did you do that? He said, because if I would have put 70 on the survey, they wouldn't have paid attention to my survey because I'm like a 50-year-old. So I put, I checked the box of 45 to 55 instead of 65 to 75 or whatever. And it was when I realized that demographic profiling no longer made sense. It was about behavior graphics and about not what your age was, but how you behaved. And all of a sudden I went back and started revamping surveys and revamping all that. And that is when I decided to migrate research from offline to online. And it was also when I realized that I was tired of getting in trouble when I coined the phrase chief troublemaker for myself, because I broke every rule that made no sense. Because when I was in the corporate world, I always listened to clients. And so I would go to my bosses and say, oh, I want to migrate research from offline to online. But my bosses, all men, they would tell me it wasn't the right time because no one was online. Mm-hmm. And I was with Larry Mock.
Yeah, sure. P&G. Yep.
The chief research officer at P&G. And I was on a panel and all my bosses, men, were in the front row and very anxious because it was one of our largest clients at the time. And I was whispering to him saying, Larry, when can I come and talk to you about migrating research from offline to online? And he said, next week. So I come off the panel and my boss said, what did you say to him? What did you say to him? I said, I just asked him, when is the right time to come and talk to you about migrating research from offline to online? And this was probably in 1998, 1999. And they said, great, Paul will go, John will go, Ringo will go, and Star will go. I'm like, but what about Shelley? I'm the one that asked and it's my idea. And they said, well, it's a boys club. And I said, well, if I'm not going to go, I'm going to cancel the meeting and you can all wait for the right time. And of course, I left well, it was called ASI at the time. Later, it was acquired by Ipsos. I left and started my own company because I decided, why do I always have to wait for everyone to tell me when it's the right time? I'd rather be my own boss. And I pioneered online testing exchange, OTX. And I pioneered online research and became the first person in the world to pioneer online research. And I was the mother of that invention.
Did you meet with Larry Mock?
Of course I did. Procter & Gamble was my first client.
All right. Excellent.
20 brands.
Larry Mock, if you had not shown up at that meeting, Larry Mock would not have been happy. So you were smart to do that for all kinds of reasons. Well, you started your own company, ended up selling it, which is a great story as well. But I want to go back to one thing you said. You're a great storyteller. Obviously, that's what you're doing in the show. How do you coach others to be better storytellers?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I sold my company, I was on a section of the New York Times. It was a big article. And the professor from my economics class, where I got a D in statistics, called me up and he said, "Are you the same Shelley Zales?" You in my class. And I ended up selling. I sold for a lot of money. Sold your research company for so much money. How is that possible? I said, because, you know, it was all about the numbers. I said, but I learned how to tell stories from data. Mm-hmm. And I said, statistics is really hard. And so I never mastered numbers. I learned how to tell stories from numbers. And by the way, just to bring this home to what we started talking about, women in sports, we sell sponsorships in sports for marketers today. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, where we really need to move is into content and into back to the soap opera days of sponsored content. It's all about storytelling. The stories about our women in sports is remarkable. Men play in general for the money. Women play for the love of the game. And the stories, if we knew about who these women are, watch me work. And by telling these stories, any marketer in the world, and not even talking about the word sponsorship, just fuel, put your money on these women by showcasing and sharing their stories. Mm-hmm. The content on these women, boom, put eyeballs on that. That is a game changer because they are remarkable. And then, by the way, watch them play, because it's incredible, and showcase that. And that's a game changer.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard you say about your career, and this is your quote, "I've always been alone." Do you still feel alone, Shelley, at this point in your career where you've done so much? You're saying no.
Throughout my career, I've always been sort of a black sheep that's a new white, because I, even when I went to pioneer online research, I've been told it's not the right time. And it wasn't. There was no ecosystem for online because nobody was online. And so I always built consortiums, but it was always 10 years ahead of itself. You know, I was building avatars in online research. My kids were avatars. I had talking surveys, or I was doing geofencing or working with QR codes. I couldn't help it though. You know, so I had to convince people that this was going to work, or the government would call me collusionary because I would bring 10 of the biggest marketers together to work on new formats, because you needed everyone to come to share, to build normative databases. Can't move with one. We all have to work together, and not in a collusionary fashion, but to share the good, bad, and the ugly, not our individual data, but to build norms. You can't create formats by yourself. It's about the power of collaboration. So I've been building normative databases with 10 non-competitive brands to move forward together. So I started CIA, the Consortium of Interactive Advertisers, IIX, the Interactive Industry Exchange, you know, with 10 Fortune 500 companies coming together my entire career. But from women supporting women, I never had girlfriends in business, ever. I'm 62 years old. Men had the boys club. We didn't have that. And I always succeeded. I sat at the table with men my whole career. I was the only female CEO, top 25 in market research. There was no one else like me. And so today, and it's why I started the Girls Lounge. You know, the opposite of boy is girl. The opposite of club is lounge. If there's a boys club, now there's a girls lounge. And not to say don't support men. You know, gender equality is men and women together, but just to have women supporting women was really important to me. or when I started the Girls Lounge, that once I had 4 million women supporting women in every category across 100 countries, I then evolved to a Quality Lounge, bringing conscious leaders together, men and women. Mm-hmm. But I first wanted women to know that bringing emotion to the boardroom is a good thing, that bringing the feminine to the workplace is a good thing, that we don't have to apologize, we don't need permission, we can leave and take our kids to the doctor and to the soccer game, we don't have to sneak out, we're not going to get fired. Why are we apologizing? This is okay, and men can do it too, but someone has to start the new pattern, or else nothing will ever change.
Yep.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com.
Now, you're coming up on the 10th anniversary of your company, The Female Quotient, and there's a lot to be proud of. We're already talking a bit about it. As you look back in those 10 years, what are you most proud of?
I sold my company to Ipsos.
Like 10, 11 years ago, right? 2015 or so.
And it was a really big move to do that. You know, I loved OTX, but, you know, when you're a mother of a child, you know what's the right thing for your child. And I knew that at some point it had to go to a big global company, you know. So my company was doing 60 million. I sold to a company doing 2.6 billion. I had six cities that we were operating in with 250 employees. I sold to a company that was operating in 83 countries with 16,000 employees. And so at some point it needed to scale. It was the right thing for my employees. For me as a serial entrepreneur, I knew I would one day not want to be at a big company like that. I'm a serial entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But for the company, it was the right thing to do. So I sold. I was now running global innovation in 83 countries, and I gave them 5 years. At the end of my 5 years, I had launched the Girls Lounge. So I built it as part of Ipsos. They wanted me to renew my contract. I was going to renew, but I said, I need you to commit in writing that you will keep the Girls Lounge going. And they gave me my contract, but the Girls Lounge was not in it in writing. And they said that they would commit to it, but they couldn't commit in writing. And I said, no commitment in writing means you're not guaranteeing. I said, so I understand that, but this is where my heart is. And so I am not going to renew my contract. I need to take the Girls Lounge with me because this is where my heart is and my passion, and this is legacy for me. So I'm going to leave with the Girls Lounge, and you can now be the first partner.
So who is the second sponsor of the Girls Lounge after Ipsos?
Me, personally.
And then the third? Who is the first company that came in a big way after Ipsos and you?
Well, this is actually a really crazy story. And so we were doing three lounges at the time. So I had Cannes and I had CES. Mm-hmm. South by Southwest. So my overhead was probably $2 million or something at the time because it's free for everybody and I do unbev space. Mm-hmm. So I put my own money in, $2.5 million, and Ipsos gave me $250,000 or something. And that's how I had the model of what it cost. And then we got invited to the World Economic Forum. And my invitation was, we want you to come, but you might not feel welcome. I went to a big financial company and said, would you sponsor us at the World Economic Forum? I needed $250,000 to create this hole in the wall. And I was going to call it the Girls Lounge, the place for the 17%, because only 17% of white badges were women. Mm-hmm. Because who does Klaus invite? Klaus Schwab invites world leaders, men, Fortune 500 CEOs, men, government officials, men, and only 17% have white badges. And this financial big company said, we will give you the funding, but you have to change the name because Girls Lounge is going to be too soft. And I said, but that's the name and I can't change it. And so they didn't fund me. So I funded it myself. My head said, who wants to go to a place you're not going to be welcome? My heart said, I have to go. And so I called Jackie Kelly, the COO of Bloomberg. I said, Jackie, you have to go with me and it's going to be lonely again. and it's going to set us back. Please go with me. She says, I'll come with you. And so we went, and all these women that have heard of us from other places popped their head in. Some came in. I had a big chandelier. I had big windows so everyone could see us. And people came with great content. Men, what the heck? And some came. And Moira Forbes had a big Forbes party, and she invited us. We were like kind of a hit. Like, who the heck are these crazy people with this chandelier and this girls' lounge? It's kind of weird. Year two, Jamie Dimon came, and he sees this lounge. He comes over to me and says, you have courage. I love this. This is the best thing that ever happened to the World Economic Forum. I'm going to be your sponsor.
Wow.
And every year he comes, his team calls and says he's building a schedule around you. He will be here. He's your sponsor. And then, of course, Anne Finucane says, why am I not speaking at this? And then everyone, why am I not speaking now? I mean, we have a two-story glass house and we are the destination. Wow. Standing room only. Everyone is welcome. We have changed the equation and have closed the gap at the World Economic Forum. We trend top five. You know, we've democratized the system. Klaus Schwab doesn't even know what to do with us because it's the buzz. Our content is remarkable.
It always is.
It was amazing. And we call it now the Equality Lounge, the place for conscious leaders. It was a game changer. And everyone comes. Everyone has the mic. It is so powerful. And we launched a really important initiative called The Flipping Point, which is all about, you know, obviously closing the gender gap, and it's now called Flipping Point 5, which is closing Global Goal 5, which is gender equality, in 5 years. The World Economic Forum says it'll take 131 years to close the gender gap. 131 years. Why?
Nuts.
And we launched this big campaign 2 years ago at Davos, and it resonated with CEOs, and it basically said, why? We created the internet in 25 years. We created a vaccine in 1 year, sent men to the moon in 10. Why should it take 131 years? And we took the gender gap and broke it into the gaps that make up the gender gap, which is the pay gap, the care gap, the bias gap, the procurement gap, less than 5% of supply chain goes to women-owned businesses, the workplace gap, you know, all of these gaps that CEOs in the lifetime of their leadership, it is the only global goal that a CEO in the lifetime of their leadership can actually close. They can't fix climate, they can't fix hunger, they can't fix education, but they actually, with prioritization, choice, and consciousness, can fix.
And by the way, when they fix that, all those other problems will get smaller.
Right. And so I said, if you're going to pick one and you want to leave a legacy of impact, choose Global Goal 5. I'm only looking for 10. 10 Fortune 500 CEOs, because once we have 10, the rest will follow. One in every category.
Yep.
Step up to the plate. And they're easy, easy fixes. We can do it in 5. That's it.
And it's ambition. And it's the right thing to do, by the way. And great CEOs will see that.
And the CMO.
Yeah, for sure.
Actually, I was at a CMO summit and I was sitting in the room with the top CMOs, and they showed data that, and the percentage, Jim, was ridiculous to me. It was like 40% of CMOs have a connection to the CEO. Mm-hmm. And then they moved on to the next conversation. I said, I'm sorry, you're all top CMOs and you just saw that number and there's no conversation about that? I said, you do realize that's a really shitty number. You don't want to fix that? You're not curious about why your number is so bad? You all talk about how there's a 3-year lifespan of CMOs in your companies. That's why.
Yeah.
You should be connected at the hip with your CEO. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about having the marketing with your consumers. You should be the best storytellers within your company. And that starts with your relationship with your CEO and communicating the purpose and the brand value within your companies. And that means you have to get that number all the way up into the 90s. And to do that, you need to be asking what's going on, because that is the most important relationship.
Yeah, and not sure is. I mean, we're talking about CMOs. This is a CMO podcast. That's an issue you just outlined. And you will not have a successful CMO if they don't have a great relationship with their CEO over and out. And that is a driver of short tenure. What do you see? You work with a lot of CMOs around the world. You have for many years. What do you see the best do exceptionally well?
Well, I think it's evolve. It's the evolution. I think language matters because it defines where you take permission. Because everyone thinks that there's this rule book of linearity or something. Like, I know you don't believe in linearity, or what was defines what is and what should be. You create your narrative and you create your path and you create your relationships. Mm-hmm. People don't work with a company. They work with people they like and they trust, period. And it's the same thing. I'm about to write this article right now about the CEO tenure and the glass cliff, because, you know, everyone keeps talking about the female CEO and the glass cliff. I don't think it's the female CEO that and the glass cliff that comes into the problem, because they set the CEO up for failure because they give them, you know, the jobs that have the problems and always hire them for that. It's the board's issue. The board sets them up for a problem. And it's the same thing with a CMO. You know, at Davos this year, the big topic was, oh, get rid of the DE&I departments. Well, why? Diversity and inclusion is so incredibly important. If you want to get rid of your DE&I departments, it means you're just not using them effectively and in the right way. Don't get rid of your department because you're not doing a good job and using them properly. You don't get rid of diversity. And you don't get rid of your culture.
Right.
That's your excuse for not doing a good job. Well, look in the mirror and ask yourself the question, you want to get rid of the words, the language, or the people, or the positions, or what is the problem? And it's the same thing with the CMO today. What is the role, the function, the relationship? Who should they be reporting into? The accountability? Because it is a really important function. But CMO, CBO, we're playing with the semantics here.
Yeah. CGO. Yeah.
There's CGO. A lot. Yeah. Right. Do you have one of everything? What's the overlap? What's the role? What's the responsibility inside, internally, externally? What's the function? Who's reporting into who? What is the role, the function, the team? How does it work together? What's the objective? Even values, purpose. You know, we're playing with words and language, and sometimes I don't even know the difference. That's how nuanced it is.
Yeah, we don't define them enough, right?
Yeah.
You have to click down to say, what do we mean when we say values? What do we mean when we say purpose? And too often we skip over that very important step. If we're not aligned on language and meaning, we'll get nowhere.
It's the same thing. Like, I talk about this all the time. I hate when people say, oh, pledge. There's a pledge. A pledge is meaningless. I want action and I want intentional action. Mm-hmm. I'm beyond a pledge. A pledge, we have seen, everyone has made pledges. We've gone backwards with pledges. I want intentional action for change. And here is the time frame, and I want the small group that is going to be connected at the hip, and collaboration is queen in my vocabulary. We have to play nice together. That's how we grow. Mm-hmm. And 1 + 1 = 11 with collaboration to a point, not sharing trade secrets, but we can play nice together. It's so incredibly important.
Yeah.
We are in a period of time where we all have to activate change, not just talk about it. Go. We're not getting younger. Don't leave it for this next generation.
So, Shelley, I want to flip into the creator brief. And the first question is, your name has become synonymous with equality. We've been talking about this for the last 45, 50 minutes. For the next several years in your career, do you want your name to be synonymous with anything else?
I hope it's synonymous with impact and change. Mm-hmm. I hope it really is synonymous with creating change and bridging the gap and collaboration. Truly, I hope that it is known for being collaborator and bringing us all together. You know, I hope I'm known for being a collaborator.
You're a prolific speaker, writer, host. What do you listen to or watch or read for inspiration?
Everything, a little of everything.
Yeah.
I'm a binge listener, watcher, hearer. And, you know, in our lounge, we have everyone there. So I'm so fortunate
yeah.
that it's like right there. And I'm all over the world. And we speak to women in 100 countries all the time. So for me, it's lived experience, which mm-hmm. is the best knowledge you can possibly get. I'm just so fortunate. And then mm-hmm. in LinkedIn, which I'm obsessed with, it's such a great thought leadership platform.
Yeah.
It's so buzzy and in real time.
It's become better at storytelling too.
I'm obsessed. And our community, you know, which we call the FQ Pack, is so real that they tell it like it is. Our influencers are real women. And so they give us kind of feedback from every category, from women in cyber to women in sports to women in construction to women in waste management to women in across every generation. So if you want to know what's going on in the world, you hear it in real time from our community in LinkedIn. They're just kind of giving you insights from everywhere.
What's the first brand you remember making an impact on you as a young girl?
Gosh, that was a long time ago. I mean, Barbie.
Why?
Well, I always wanted to be a flight attendant. So, you know, that always resonated with me, even though my sister tells me, you know, I'm one of four girls. So she remembers our Barbie dolls. We had so many of them. So, you know, that was a brand that really always resonated with me. And I was an athlete. So, you know, I played sports.
What was your sport, Shelley?
Tennis. So I was a tennis player. And so Chrissy Evert was a role model for me.
Yeah.
But I also loved McEnroe because he was a troublemaker. So. Yeah,
right.
I was actually at Wimbledon when McEnroe beat Borg.
Oh, wow.
And I was with my sisters there and we were rooting for Mac. And, you know, and of course the Brits were all for Borg. And sure. So I remember them turning around and saying to me, because we were screaming so loud, they said, "You're not at an American football game." Like, we'll never forget that. You know, I mean, so many brands. I mean, even Alka-Seltzer, just, I'll never forget that as a young researcher, knowing that they did plop, plop, fizz, fizz with two plops and two fizzes because there was two, and learning that they only needed one, but for selling more, they put two in. So just little things about, mm-hmm. you know, or I just met Affleck and I worked on that campaign before the duck. Of course, so many things with like a girl, you know, so.
Yeah.
That young girl to me was being a young girl in advertising and just every package that I worked on. I mean, I worked on Tropicana before as they changed the packaging every time. And so the curiosity for me with watching the advertising change and how creators are now so influential. So to me, that's young girl in advertising.
Yeah. What's the first brand that made an impact on you in the equality space?
Like a Girl. I mean, to me, that was just so impressionable, so incredible, really resonated, powerful.
Yep. A good P&G brand, the good P&G team. Now, you and I are both in our 60s. We're both grandparents. What do you love about this stage of life?
Choice, you know, and doing what I want when I want. I mean, I think I always did that no matter what, but, and that I am creating the future. Now, you know, I don't wait and watch. You know, my father always taught me to have a no regret policy, never look back and say shoulda, woulda, coulda. And I always did that. You know, it's sort of why I say that all the time to everyone that I work with. I've worked for, hopefully the generations coming up, that I always think you've got to think about the future and say, will I have a regret? Will I feel bad with this choice? And if the answer is yes, don't do it, because no one will ever remember the meeting, the business trip you didn't take or the meeting that you missed. Mm-hmm. But the people important in your life will always remember you were there for those moments. And that's why I talk a lot about life stage accommodation. You got to think about those things and why I'm building these different workplace accommodations that we need to do now. That equality is possible if you want it. And there's no reason that we should be still retrofitting or just throwing junk in the trunk today and not just building an inclusive workplace. It is all possible. It just needs to be designed inclusively and it is not complicated. And that's legacy for me. And legacy while I'm here. and why I have the power to do it, and why collectively we can collectively design the workplace that will work for everyone. It is not hard. And with people like you and me and you know, all of us here, like, what are we waiting for?
Who's been the most inspiring person in your life, Shelley?
Well, you know, what's really crazy, and this is actually really quite remarkable, my mom, and I know everyone says their mom, but my mom created the first conference for women for the governor, the former governor of California, for Pete Wilson, 30 years ago.
Wow.
And it was called the Conference for Women for the State of California. And that was my mother, Rosalie Zales. And it is pretty crazy. I actually found the agenda from it. And it's what I do today.
What was on her agenda? That's fascinating.
Everything I do today. I mean,
so Shelley, you're in the right role in life, Shelley. You were, it was meant to be.
It's so full circle, but in a million gazillion years, I swear to God, I was at her first one. I was 30 years old. I remember thinking to myself, I never thought I'd be in the business of equality. I went from the business of research to the business of equality. I remember going to this thinking, wow, my mom. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom when I was growing up. I mean, she always was head of this foundation, head of that foundation, you know, whatever. Then when we all left the house, my mom went to work for the governor of California. She was his senior policy advisor. And then she started this conference for women, not because she was in the business of equality, but because, I mean, this was actually very clever. She thought this is a great way for him to get women's votes. Hmm. That's why. Hmm. I'm in it for a different reason, but she did it for that. And when I was 30, I thought to myself, God, this is crazy. Why are all these women coming to a conference for women? She had 5,000 women in Long Beach, California. And we just went as her daughters to support. And I thought, these women are all like sharing such vulnerable things. This is so weird. I thought it was weird. Like, that's what I thought. Like, I actually remember that. And today, look at what I am doing. And they had boxed lunches, 5,000 women for the state of California showed up and paid some money. And then Maria Shriver took it over when my mom retired from doing it. Yeah. And I received the Matrix Award. I received this big award for leadership.
No, it is a big award. Congratulations.
And I had my mother present me the award, which was really incredibly meaningful. My mom is 87 years old and is like a 60-year-old. And she was actually more remarkable and memorable than, I mean, people will never forget that moment. It was quite remarkable.
Well, make sure she listens to the show, Shelley. If she listens to the podcast, I think she'd be very proud. I'm sure she's very proud now, but I think this would be a nice show for her to listen to. And this is a good way for us to wrap up this beautiful conversation, Shelley. I mean, I had about 100 other questions, but we talked about the right stuff. And it's so good to see you. Thank you for everything you're doing for the industry, for people, for women, for men. I look forward to seeing you in about 6 weeks at Cannes. And thank you again for this gift.
Well, I want to thank you, Jim, honestly, for all that you do. And you are a legend and also so incredibly inspiring. I want to actually interview you for all that you do, for, you know, where you've been, where you are, where you're going, and the important work that you're doing, because the conversations that you have do lead to intentional action. And you are inspiring all of us to be better and to make sure that we put our actions forward. And I hope that I can return the conversation.
I would be honored anytime, anytime. Thank you, Shelley. That was my conversation with Shelley Zales. Three takeaways from this one for your business, brand, and life. The first one, storytelling is a key skill in anyone's career. Shelley is really good at this. She's gotten better at it over time. She talked about the power of storytelling to move causes, move people, move businesses. So I think the takeaway is, how good are you at storytelling? And is there anything you learned in this show to help you be a better storyteller? Second takeaway, the power of tenaciousness and determination about your ideas and your sense of what's right and your sense of purpose. Shelley believes in herself, believes in the ideas she's fighting for, and goes to great lengths to make them happen. This was a great leadership lesson in the power of determination and tenacity with your ideas and your purpose. And the last takeaway, and this gets back to purpose, Shelley has a tremendous personal purpose on equality and on impact. When I asked her, does she want to stand for anything beyond equality in the next years of her career? And she said, impact. Shelley is all about those two ideas. Everything she does emanates from those. So for all of us, it makes me think anyway about the crispness of my personal purpose and am I activating it in all I do? And the last takeaway, I love the story about her mom and how her mom led this conference for women for the governor of California more than 30 years ago. The takeaway is, you know, there's lessons about career management and career and personal purpose from our parents. And we hear a lot of people in the show say their inspiration is their parents. But I think it's always a source of great inspiration for all of us to learn from our wonderful parents. That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribed so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production. Episodes of the CMO Podcast are produced by Gallery Media Group. The views and opinions expressed by podcast speakers and guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of our sponsors or its personnel, nor do our sponsors advocate or endorse any individuals or entities featured on the episodes.